Vaccines save lives. That statement is short and easy, but here's a longer one that complicates it. Many people do not trust vaccines. And so it should come as no surprise to find that the current session of the Oregon legislature will consider a bill or two dealing with vaccines and the requirement that students get a number of vaccines before they are allowed to attend public school. Oregon Senate Bill 579 would change the approach to vaccine exemptions. It has the support of Oregonians for Medical Freedom. We have two guests with us in support of the bill's concepts. Robert Snee is in Portland. He's an attorney and the committee director of Oregonians for Medical Freedom. He's on the phone with us. Robert, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me on the show.
You bet. Good to have you here. And we have Diane Powell with us as well, who is a medical doctor, an MD from Medford. Thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you both here. Rob, let's start with you. Is Oregonians for Medical Freedom all about vaccines, or are there some broader medical concerns?
It's all about protecting the rights of patients to have informed consent for any and all medical procedures, and that includes vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
We think it's important that patients have full information, that they have full information about the risks and benefits, and that they have the right to say no to any medical procedure, and that includes vaccines.
What are some of the specific concerns you have about vaccines?
Many of the concerns were expressed this morning through Robert F. Kennedy Jr. at a press conference he gave in Washington about the fact that a lot of the science that is relied upon by the CDC is fraudulent studies and flawed studies. There's a lot of folks that receive injuries from vaccines. Over $3.3 billion has been paid out in compensation by the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, yet people aren't even aware that that program exists.
And, in fact, it is mentioned in the bill, which I'll get to in just a little bit. I want to bring Diane Powell in here. I mean, as an MD, you do see some value in vaccines, I presume.
I do, but I want to give you a perspective that I'm sure that you've never heard before, because I'm not only an MD, but I'm a specialist in autism. And it was 30 years ago that I was in London at the Institute of Psychiatry with Sir Michael Rutter, who was knighted for his work on autism and neurodevelopmental disorders. And I specifically went to work with him to learn about them, and I can recognize them. And so this is my specialty. And one of the things that I have seen is that there has been a rapid increase in autism being diagnosed. And I have the credentials to say whether or not a child actually has autism versus another neuropsychiatric disorder. And so what happened is that when I studied with Sir Michael Rutter, it was to be able to distinguish between the different causes of a child becoming mute, let's say. And what I discovered is that a lot of the children now being diagnosed as having autism actually have a different kind of brain damage. That, you know, they don't have autism. What they have is they have an overactivation of immune cells that are in their brain. This is new science that has not been translated into clinical practice. We didn't realize until the last 15 years that we actually have 10% of the brain cells that we have are microglia, and they act like macrophages, and they are stimulated by any kind of immune system activation in the periphery. We didn't know that the immune system in the periphery communicated with an immune system in our brain. And so what's happening is that a lot of children during a time period in which the microglia are more at risk for being activated because they play a critical role in sculpting the brain during the learning process. So when a child is learning how to do certain things, that part of the brain is it's undergoing more development, and the synapses that aren't being reinforced are being removed by the microglia. That's their role. And so during the first 4 years of life, you have these children who are having their immune system challenged to an extreme degree, and there are more and more of these children that are being reported as being different after vaccination. And yet, because of this mantra that vaccines don't cause autism, when you have, you know, most of the autism being diagnosed in this country being done by pediatricians and family doctors who don't have my credentials to be able to recognize it. So
are you saying flat out then that vaccines cause autism?
What I'm saying is that there is a way in which children can be vaccinated safely And so one of the things I wanted to mention was the work of Dr. Paul Thomas, because what he did was is he studied three different groups of children, those who followed the CDC protocol, and 1 out of 60 of those children were diagnosed with autism. Of the children who were not vaccinated, none of them developed autism. Of the children who followed his protocol, which is just basically saying, let's be a little less aggressive, vaccinate only for things we need to vaccinate for, and make sure that the child is healthy when they receive a vaccination. Don't give it to them when they're already fighting some cold that they picked up at daycare. And if you follow that plan, then there was zero children out of 1,100, almost 1,100 children that had autism. And so I think we need to have that information.
Diane Powell's an MD in Medford. Robert Snee is an attorney in Portland. He is the committee director for Oregonians for Medical Freedom, and they're looking at legislation that would make some changes to the way that vaccines are given to children in Oregon, or at least the requirements involving public school. You can join our conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. It was interesting when you came in here, though, because you brought the book by Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis called The Vaccine Friendly Plan that we had quite a robust discussion about several months ago. Is that what you're adhering to now, the idea that the vaccines can be given, just not at the times in life they are currently given?
That's right. We just need to have some modifications of the protocol. We need to make sure that the children's immune system is properly fed with nutrition. In other words, children who have a vitamin D deficiency, for example, because vitamin D is important for the immune system to function properly, they're more likely to have a reaction to a vaccine. So if we just take, and this is really what I'm advocating for, is we as Oregonians, we as a state, have the ability to choose. It's the state mandated the vaccine schedule. We as Oregonians can make a choice about, do we want to follow a protocol like Dr. Thomas's, in which we just make sure that we have, healthy mothers, healthy babies, and when we're vaccinating the babies.
Robert Snee, what about the current regime would you like to see changed as it relates to schools and exemptions?
What I'd like to see is more information given to people, the fact that exemptions even exist. If you look at any of the publications that are sent out by the OHA or any of the school departments, all they list are the vaccines are required, but they don't even inform people that they have a right to claim exemptions to those vaccines.
Well, as I read the bill that is up for discussion now, Senate Bill 579, it's already been introduced and sent to committee and haven't heard anything from it since, but we can get to that in just a bit. It appears to flip the relationship between vaccinator and receiver of vaccine. I mean, what does the healthcare practitioner need, assuming this bill becomes law, if this bill becomes law, before giving a vaccine?
Nothing more than what they already have available, actually. And there's a bill that's currently in legislative council that's very similar to 579, which would include some additional language that would provide for additional information to make informed consent truly informed consent. One would be a requirement that the doctors make available a vaccine package insert. Currently, under the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, patients are already required to be given the vaccine information statement prepared by the CDC. But that's a one-page document that lists very few of the adverse events that are possible that are listed on the vaccine package insert. People ought to be aware of the fact that there are, even though there are minor risks of these things, and the risks are relatively low, those risks do exist. I did a study a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, on the vaccine adverse event reporting system for Oregon. And they say that risks are like one in a million. But under the VAR's system, in Oregon alone, it came out to about an average of one in 4,500 had an adverse event. That's not one in a million, which is a statistic that's often quoted by the CDC and the OHA as to what the risks are for injuries from vaccines.
All right. As I'm looking at Section 2 of Senate Bill 579, there's a whole thing in here about how the healthcare practitioner shall obtain informed consent from parent of the child, or if the child is emancipated or has reached the age of maturity, the child. How does that differ from the relationship now, Diane Powell, with what you have to do to deliver a vaccine to a patient?
Well, I don't. I'm in a specialty where I actually don't deliver vaccines.
You don't do vaccines at all.
Mm-hmm. What I do is I deal with the consequences of children who've been vaccinated, and I'm looking at them and assessing, you know, what's going on here. And so I became alarmed because when I was 30 years ago, when I was with Sir Michael Rutter, I was told I was in academic medicine. I was told don't specialize in autism because you'll never see a case again, because back then it was 1 in 10,000. And when I heard that from the CDC statistics that it was up to 1 in 68, then I got back in to this as a researcher trying to understand what's causing this. And then when I saw that the vaccines were playing a role,
we're playing a role, but what the role? Can you say for sure vaccines cause autism? Is it that simple?
I can say that what is being labeled autism. These children are being labeled as autism. Autism is a syndrome. And so you just need to be and so a lot of doctors, they see a child developing normally and then they stop talking and they regress developmentally, they get labeled autistic. Not automatically. And as a psychiatrist and neurologist, I look at that child and I say, that's an encephalopathy. And an encephalopathy is a recognized risk of vaccines. And what's happening is that a lot of children are being misdiagnosed, which skews the statistics even further.
So it's not autism. It's another condition of the brain.
That's right.
Can it be treated on that basis then, do you think?
A lot of these children, about 20% of these children can have their symptoms reversed. Because what they have is a chronic inflammatory condition going on in their brain. And what you can do is you can reduce the inflammation. You can look at their gut biome is totally out of whack. They're nutritionally extremely depleted. And if you address their diet and you address their gut biome and various things, a lot of these children, they start becoming included in regular classrooms.
Are there other symptoms that come along with the encephalopathies that you're talking about here? I mean, are there food sensitivities, allergies, things like that?
A lot of these children have these sensitivities, and it's because really what we're looking at is a condition in which it's an immune disorder. And the immune disorder is not just in our body, it's in our brain. And so what we're seeing here is that there's these brain cells, the microglia, when they're not active, they're actually nourishing cells. They actually provide a lot of nutrients the brain needs. So it doesn't need to be that they're attacking the brain. It could be that they're just not nourishing the brain.
Diane Powell's an MD. Robert Snee is an attorney. They are talking about ways to change the relationship between healthcare providers and the people they vaccinate and Oregon schools, potentially through legislation like Senate Bill 579. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning. I have been listening to this conversation, and my intuition causes me to ask, is there the possibility of a genetic predisposition for some kind of a reaction in these cases, Doctor?
Good question. Thanks for that, Paul.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Sure.
and thank you for asking that. Yes, I'm also somebody who had studied genetics, and I was part of the Human Genome Project and studied molecular biology at UCSD. And I was looking at the genetics, and there are over 1,200 genes that have been associated with autism. And we only have about 24,000 genes in our entire human genome. And so that tells me, and within the same family, when they looked at siblings in which two children had autism, they found that 70% of the siblings didn't have the same genetic variation that they thought was tied to the autism. So to me, that we know that some people are more predisposed to have an adverse reaction, but we think that actually it's the nutritional and health status of the child at the time of vaccination and the age of vaccination that plays more of a role.
Robert Snee, I was reading material that indicated that one of your children had had a reaction to a vaccine. What was the situation there?
He had a reaction where his entire body swelled up initially. He didn't urinate for 24 hours. He eventually developed some speech disfluency, some developmental delays. This happened over 20 years ago.
All right. You mentioned earlier in the program the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which is also mentioned in the bill, Senate Bill 579. What is it?
The National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program is set up because in 1986, Congress gave blanket immunity to doctors and vaccine manufacturers for any injury caused by their product. And the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program set up a program whereby people who are injured from vaccines can apply to through a federal court program to receive compensation for that. Unfortunately, doctors don't tell patients about it. Doctors deny that any reactions are related to the vaccines. Even when, you know, something occurs within hours after the vaccine, the doctors say, oh, it must be something else. So many times doctors aren't even trained to recognize what are adverse events from vaccines. And so patients who are injured from vaccines have a short period of time, a statute of limitations period, where when they finally discover and look back as to the cause of their child's injury, oftentimes it's too late to approach that program. And it was initially supposed to be set up as a non-confrontational program, but it is very difficult to receive compensation from the program. And they've taken the position where if you apply for damages for autism, then your claim will be denied. But if you claim that the vaccine caused encephalopathy, then possibly you may have, which leads to back to autism, then you may result in receiving compensation. In fact, over 83 cases have received compensation for injuries that ultimately resulted in autism.
Okay, Robert, we got about a minute left. We've already established that Diane favors the system that Paul Thomas and Jennifer Margulis presented here a few months ago in their book, The Vaccine-Friendly Plan, which just talks about same vaccines but perhaps later and distributed differently on a schedule. How do you feel about that?
I think it makes sense. And when you look at the public statement that was issued by a senior scientist from the CDC over 2 years ago, Dr. William Thompson, which did a 2004 study on the relationship of the timing of the MMR vaccine and autism in Atlanta students, he came forward and stated that his superiors told him to hide the data that showed that children who received the vaccine later in life had a much lower chance of getting autism than those who received it according to the CDC schedule.
All right.
He's come forward and admitted that, but yet we've had no congressional hearings on his admitting scientific fraud by the CDC.
Okay, speaking of hearings, haven't had any scheduled so far on Senate Bill 579, which is supported by Oregonians for Medical Freedom. Robert Snee is an attorney and the committee director for OFMF. Diane Powell is an MD from Medford, and thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.